Welcome to First Star Let's Chat, an athletic therapy podcast. I'm your host, James Gardner, certified athletic therapist, certified strength and conditioning specialist, yoga instructor, human being. This platform for the pros, by the pros, anybody in the performance space, and beyond. Welcome here to share in the stories of professionals, experiences, journeys, learning along the way. It's a platform to connect, to network, and to be a part of a community that cares with conversations that matter, experiences that resonate, and generate ideas, thought-provoking, organic dialogue, passionate probes. Brought to you as always by First Star Therapy, Mobility Tape, Epic, and Benchmark Athletics. In association with the Canadian Athletic Therapists Association, it's First Star Let's Chat, an athletic therapy podcast. Thanks for being here. Thank you for being a part of it.
All right, here we go. Little hiatus since our time in Israel with the WFAT International Congress, but jumping back on board here, really special guest this evening. Met through a third party out on the West Coast doing some really great work. I'll go through your bio, Michael, and then we'll jump in here. Michael Lodowicz is a writer, coach, teacher, and athlete. You might say his life revolves around sport. He's also an avid meditator, which has taught him the power of the mind, not only in sport, but in life. Because he believed the mind is so powerful, he recently wrote a book about the mental side of sport called On the Ball. The book reflects on his experiences as a volleyball coach for over 25 years at a variety of levels, including high school, club, provincial team, and university. He's also spent a great deal of time teaching tennis. After completing a Master's of Education degree in coaching studies in 2013, he began teaching kinesiology courses at the University of Winnipeg. He also taught motor learning for 1 year at the University of Manitoba and biomechanics for 1 year at the University of British Columbia. When there's time, you'll find him playing tennis at the local courts where he lives in Vancouver. He lives with his partner, Angela Griffith, and their dog, Rudy. Mike, welcome aboard, man. Really appreciate you carving some time into your time.
I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
Yeah, and I have the book right in front of me. I've chipped away at it. And I mean this in the most humbling and confident manner, that it's an easy read. And I mean that from lots of anecdotes, lots of relatable pieces. I love just like chipping away, plugging it, putting it down, picking it back up again, and being able to pick up right where I left off. Magic Minute. Let's start there, because I think that's a great lead in for where we want to go. I'll leave it at that. You take it, and then we'll run from there.
Yeah, sounds good. So this is something that I do with my athletes and teams. So it's typically done right before competition. Oh, we also do it right before practices, just to kind of practice it. But it provides a lot of value before a competition. So I'll just do it, and then I'll talk a little bit more about it after. How's that sound?
Sure, sounds great.
Okay, so what we would do is if you're in a team, you would hold hands in a circle. But of course, we're individuals, so we'll just be on our own here. And we'll close our eyes. And the first thing we'll do is we'll take five, what I call relief breaths. So those are in through the nose. And then you let it all out through the mouth like it's falling out. And now five relaxation breaths. So now it's in through the nose and then long and slow out the mouth. Now feel the energy in the hands. And feel the energy in your feet. And And then set your intention for the day or a little goal for the day. Be aware of the sounds around you. And be thankful for what you have. And then open your eyes. And now take five power breaths. So it's in through the nose, out through the mouth fast. That's done. That's a magic minute. There you
I
go.
love this. I love this as an intro for the audience. Rewind it. Do it again. You and I have never met in person. I always get a little bit of anxiousness when I haven't, met somebody in person. Don't know what it's going to be like. Don't really know where the conversation is going to head. But this is a great lead into a conversation where put all of that aside, hone into the breath, the power of the breath, and take this wherever you want in terms of your intention in delivering this with athletes and in the athletic space. But for me, just coming in, hosting this conversation on this podcast with whoever's listening and willing to listen, but you sharing your time, it takes the edge off for me. And I can sort of just lean into this conversation. I can concentrate a little bit more. I can focus
Yeah.
in on what we're doing. So take it wherever you want to go from there.
Yeah, I mean that's exactly like you said, it helps to settle you down. And so I introduced this to the athletes that I coach, and we try to do it immediately before the competition, so as close to sort of tip off or whatever the sport may be, as close as possible. And it just primes the mind. It just It's also nice to do it because you're in the environment. Let's say you're starting a basketball game and you're right there on the side of the bench. So you're in the gym, you hear the sights and the sounds, and it sort of tells the unconscious mind that everything is okay, with some nice breaths. And it's actually funny how I stumbled upon this, because this is something, I mean, maybe there's other coaches and people out there doing it, but I kind of came up with it on my own. But it's funny how I came up with it. It was many, many years ago. I'm an avid tennis player, as you said in the bio in the intro there. I played competitively for many, many years, and I always thought, oh, that match I played really well. I was in the zone there. And then, oh, that match, oh yeah, I was in the zone in that match. But it wasn't until I truly experienced the zone one day where it really was something special, where every shot I made and everything was so calm and quiet. I was so confident. It was just a magical day where nothing went wrong. I just put together this incredible performance. But what happened was, this was well before I got into meditation and the Magic Minute or any of this stuff. But what happened was, my partner was had just finished the singles final, and he was cramping from the heat. And so what happened, I showed up for the doubles game, and I knew he was in rough shape. But I walked onto the court for the start time, and the convener came over to me, walked on the court, and said, "Hey, your partner, he needs a few more minutes of rest, so we're gonna bump the start time down. We're back about 20 minutes." I said, "Yeah, that's fine." So, 20 minutes didn't have much to do. So I thought, oh, I'll just stay here and sit on by the side of the court. And so I wasn't going to hit balls against the wall or anything like that. So I thought, I'll just close my eyes here. And like I said, I'd never meditated before, but I'll close my eyes and I listened to some sounds and got familiar with the environment. And then everybody showed up and we played the match. And I didn't realize till after, but that was a big part in why I performed so well, was that little bit of time before, just settling into the space that I was at, and enabled me to put together a great performance. And so I continued to do that. I still put it for myself as a tennis player, and then I give it to the teams, and the teams all really, really like it. It's a little bit different than meditation. You take five relaxation breaths, which is, it's not like a 10-minute meditation. I know some teams are doing that. It's a little different in terms of, like, it kind of gets at a lot of things. And even the power breath sort of gives you a little bit of energy and confidence at the end. Like, okay, let's go, let's do this. Here are my five power breaths. So it's something that I just kind of created and evolved over time. But I think every athlete I've ever coached or given this to has really liked it. Some of them have a little bit tougher time of doing it right before the competition, and there's people around, and we're here, we're holding hands and closing our eyes, so that can be a bit uncomfortable at first. But once you get used to it, it just becomes your team thing, and they just start to love it. And you almost look forward to that minute. And when you don't do it, some practices, maybe you're in a rush or something, you don't do the Magic Minute, it just doesn't feel right, or you feel off. So yeah, that's, there you go. That's one of the As you said, my book's on the ball, and it's a whole bunch of mental tools, and that's one of many. So, and there you go.
Yeah, and a perfect one. And I love that piece of like, the hand holding, and we kind of skip over that and go to the breath, but like the hand holding, the physical contact, that connection to your teammates if you're in a team sport, right? Or potentially connecting to your racket, the ball, the stick, whatever the implement is that you may be using in an individual sport, something like that. 'Cause it allows you, and you said it, like it allows you to feel like everything's okay. You're in a familiar territory, even though it may be unfamiliar, whether it's championship game or, the court's facing a different direction, the sounds, the environment, connecting with the environment on top of the physical connection to those that are closest to you and in support of you in the heat of the battle. Like that, those are some really, really value adds, I think, for athletes that aren't doing it, or even in my space, like as a practitioner, I've begun to lean into, we used to use like, okay, first 5 minutes, like you're busy and you're running around with X number of patients. And then the next one comes in and you're like, oh, just hop on the bike for 5 minutes and get yourself ready for treatment. Instead of let's get you on the table and we'll talk like, down regulation, get you comfortable in the environment. Or if I'm with you beside the table, just coaching you through a few breaths, it breeds a little bit of trust there as well, I think, from a practitioner or a coach to athlete. Do you find that's part of the equation, or is that kind of, am I just jumping way into the deep end here?
No, I'm totally with you on that. And if you gave me two options, to prepare for a competition, you said, okay, option one, you can lift a bunch of weights and get all pumped up and listen to music and get yourself going. Or option B was just to lay down completely silent and close your eyes or in a meditative state or a meditative position or whatever. That's option two. I would take option two in a heartbeat. 10 years ago, I'd say, oh no, I need option one. I need the music to get me pumped up. I need to get my muscles moving. But it's totally changed for me now, and I'm a firm believer in the mind and the mental state. And so yeah, I'm totally with you on that. One thing to add, which is kind of cool about what you're saying about the touch and the holding the hands. One of the teams I had, after doing it for a while, a whole year actually, all of a sudden their breaths were all fully in sync. And then they said towards the end of the year, one time they said, oh, that was really cool. We all felt extra energy. It was almost like the energy went all the way around the circle. So it's almost like when you become a team and things, and you gel, all of a sudden that energy is felt. So that was a really, when they gave me that feedback, I was like, oh, that's really, really interesting. Can't explain that at all, but that's really, really neat.
Yeah, and amazing, sort of in the space of, high performing athletes or athletes that are in the spotlight all the time. We talk like major sports that are on TV, and all of a sudden there's a team that's performing really, really well, but nobody expected it to happen. But there's a cohesion in the locker room or in the clubhouse or on the field or on the ice or whatever that's virtually unexplainable. And I'd imagine, there's some part of this of knowing where your teammate is, knowing where your partner is on the court. Like these are things that are taught by spending time together, but also getting in sync, right? Whether that's energetically or physically or a combination of both.
Yeah, and the first one to do this was well, I shouldn't say the first one to do this, but one of the first coaches I heard in this space was Phil Jackson. Of course, I think most of your listeners would know the name with the Bulls and the Lakers. And he was doing this. He had something similar to Magic Minute, where he had all the athletes, like the Rodmans and Pippins and Jordans. He'd have them all in the locker room, sitting in a circle with the lights out, doing a little meditation of some kind with some breathing. You do that before games. And that was back in the early 80s when he introduced that. And everyone kind of frowned, not frowned upon it, but like was questioning him and saying, what's he doing? But his results just speak for themselves. He had 11 championships in 20 years, which is like absolutely incredible. And he was just a firm believer in the mind and preparing the mind for competition. So yeah, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, and I think like a little wooey, like it's like whoa, what are you doing there? Like you're entering some territory. That's not sport specific. That's not performance. That's a little like out there and whatever term you might want to use. But your book really reminds me of I read George Mumford's book, and George was the I believe he was Phil Jackson's right hand when it came to this, and he wrote a book called The Mindful Athlete. Another great read, and for those that are listening, like these are two great books and great resources. And I think like all of this spills over to performance and getting in the corner of your athletes for them to understand who and what they need. I work with a younger guy who's now transitioning away from pro sport into coaching, from a performance coach standpoint. And he spent you know, some time doing a specialization in mindfulness. And he really identified with the fact that he can't be in a locker room, or couldn't when he was playing, where there was that high amplitude music and, you know, like, you know, the sort of the machismo in the locker room, like that just didn't get him where it needed to be. In fact, it had the inverse effect. So I'll just spin this as a question to you. Have you found anybody that hasn't responded well to these types of techniques, or the hesitation, or I don't know, the lack of willingness to try it at first, or did they all fall into it when sort of the leaders were doing it?
Yeah. So, you know, I introduced meditation to one team. I talk a lot in the book about this one team. I was with them for 4 years. Yeah. And I first introduced meditation 1 year. And that was really hard for me as a coach, because it just really was, it kind of felt uncomfortable. I didn't know what was going to happen. I don't know if they'd like it or if they'd hate it. But anyways, it was a team of, you know, 12, say 14 athletes. And, you know, I got them all in a room that first day and said, okay, we're going to meditate. And a few of them chuckled. And then we did, like we used the Headspace app, and I think we did like a 5 or 8 minute meditation. And, I kind of had my eyes closed, but I kind of opened my eyes to see how people were doing. And I noticed like two athletes were just, you know, they're kind of fidgeting and they weren't really into it. They were just kind of sitting there. They didn't make any noise, but they were just sitting there. And so that kind of was a bit troublesome for me, because I was expecting all the athletes to do it.
Right.
So before the next practice, you know, that was day one of meditating with the group. Before the second day, I really wanted to continue this, but I was a little bit fearful of it. And I was very tempted to jump ship on the plan. And then one of our top athletes, our grade 12 athletes, came up to me and said, "Hey, Mike, can we meditate again today?" And I said, "Oh, that's awesome." I said, "You know, that there you go. That's the fuel for the fire. I'm going to keep going." So I did it again. And, you know, we made that part of our practice. But to answer your question, is those two athletes, I had to provide them with some other ways to, like some other ways of introspection and kind of training the mind. And journaling seemed to be the one that got both of them. I guess a lot of people just aren't comfortable closing their eyes. They don't really want to know. It's a bit scary, whatever that may be, but, they just didn't want to do it. And they were still in the room for the meditations, but they would just lie there or do whatever. And I was fine with that, but got them to journaling, tried some other mental skills with them, and they're quite okay with that. So yeah, these things are not for everybody. But the magic minute, everyone's done it. I think everyone can handle that. You know, it's 1 minute. It's, you know, as you just did it, I think most people could do that. And it's part of the team. And if you're part of the team, you do it. So, that one I've never had any people having trouble with, but meditation definitely is one that's, I've understood that it's clearly not for everybody. So, having a variety of tools for your athletes is essential.
Yeah, that variety, and then that adaptability or willingness to be pliable as a coach or practitioner. For me, it trickles into the world of knowing who's in the room. You have to know each individual, and you have to know where they're coming from and what their experiences have been and those kinds of things as we build these skills. And I think these skills are relatable to everybody on some level, like you mentioned. Before we get too far down that path and how it's working and, you know, the book and all these great things, like your credentials, man, like you've taught at multiple universities in lots of different areas. How did that sort of spill into where you are now? I mean, biomechanics, like some high quality education, has that sort of helped you develop, you know, the, I don't want to say formula, but the structure, the framework of what you're doing now?
Yeah. So a couple things, sort of changed my life and my career path quite a bit. The first one being moving to Vancouver from Winnipeg. So I taught at the University of Winnipeg for 13 years. And by the end of it, I was teaching, you know, sport related courses and principles of coaching. I was teaching some faculty of education courses for PE teachers. And I quite liked my job, and I was getting good at it. I, you know, getting some repetitive courses, and I was really liking my job. But what happened was we moved to Vancouver. My partner got placed there. So I had to sort of start fresh. And although that was very stressful and difficult, you know, looking back, it just expanded my life immensely. You know, I picked up some courses at UBC. I got into meditation. I taught more tennis lessons, and then picked up volleyball. So just all of a sudden, it's sort of a reset in life. And then I was kind of getting going and getting cruising again. And then the pandemic was the second you know, abrupt change to my life, because I discontinued my position with UBC. And I was also teaching some courses overseas in Thailand, but of course travel was done, so that was discontinued.
Right.
So again, I was sort of not starting fresh, but it was just some changes had to be made. And so that was about when the book came about, and I finally felt like, oh, it's time to write about this mental stuff because it's just so powerful, and I just love it. Ironically, I've never taught sports psych. So I've taught everything but university kinesiology and sport courses. And it's the one that I'm most sort of passionate about lately. Everything in the book and everything that I know is just all through experiences, as you said, like as an athlete, coach, and teacher. So, and now currently I'm, I'm not teaching any university courses, currently. I'm just doing some substitute teaching at the high school level. But the book has been the big thing, getting that finished it a couple months ago, and now I'm selling copies of it. But I'm also giving back to the community. I give a lot of tennis lessons, and I still help out with volleyball camps and clinics and stuff like that. So I'm definitely still busy. But I'm not doing any university courses, and but I'll probably get back into that space when something comes around.
Yeah, amazing. And again, it's Mike Ladowicz is our guest this evening, author of On the Ball: Short Stories, Anecdotes, and Words of Wisdom on the Mental Side of Sport. Pick it up. Plug that right now. Like, where can people find that? What's the easiest way to go about getting hands on this? I have it right in front of me. Like I said, I'll go back and read this multiple times. It's just one of those ones I can pick up, kind of open the page wherever I open it and feel like I'm going to get something out of it.
Yeah, right on. So it's on Amazon, amazon.com, and you're probably best to search for my name, Michael Lodowicz. I don't think you'll find it if you search for On the Ball. Like I said, this is all pretty new to me, getting this book out. So I'm not super searchable, but I think if you go to amazon.com and type in my name, if you spell it right, that should bring you to the book. So yeah.
Yeah, just like it sounds, Lodewyks. It's not maybe not exactly as it sounds, but anyway,
Yeah.
a really great stuff. And like I said, like high value. Pick it up, read it. You're gonna take some skills away. You'll get some great stories out of there. You have a lot of like personal bits in there, which are completely relatable, I think, to most people when you know they get to know you a little bit as an author and those kind of things. Stepping back just to like the West Coast, that shift, you know, I spent a year in Vancouver just up until last November, and it's different, right? Like the environment is different out there. For me, it was like went from Toronto, which is like hard edges and everybody's the most important person in the world when you walk down the street kind of thing, to sort of a little bit rounder edges, lots of activity, lots of outdoor space. Did the environment out there sort of shape your or reveal the path of meditation to you or sort of relate? I don't know, Vancouver and the West Coast and where your meditation sort of how that revealed itself to you or if they're unrelated.
Yeah, I definitely think they're related. As soon as I got to Vancouver, I met up with a guy that I taught a whole bunch of lessons to. We were going regularly almost every morning, and we got kind of deep into, after each session we'd sit on the side of the court and we'd get it deep into life with some chats. And he convinced me to try Headspace, which was something I was like, no, meditation, not for me. And I went home and did it, and I took his challenge, and I did the 10 days, and right away I was like, wow, this is there's something to this. And then a couple of years later, after practicing Headspace 10 minutes every morning, I think for those 2 years, a friend of mine was doing a 10-day Vipassana course. He had already done one, and he was looking forward to a second one, and I was like, you're looking forward to a second 10-day course where you meditate for 10 and a half hours every day, so you're over 100 hours of meditation in 10 days. I said, how could you possibly be looking forward to that? But he was already well into it. And but what happened was, he wanted to stay with me before and after because it was close to Vancouver. So I said, yeah, sure. He convinced me to do it. I dragged myself there really scared and not and unsure. It was absolutely life-changing. Not just learning the technique, but just in all senses, it was like I learned so much about pain, because of course you go through pain, but you learn that much of your pain, if not all of your pain, is all from the mind, and the skills you get from that, like even to this day, If I ever get back pain, I can just go sit on the meditation cushion and I can eliminate it in 20 minutes just because I know how. So just stuff like that is really, it's just cool to have that. And I guess to answer your question, I think finding meditation really was a turning point for me. But I think that came about from the move to Vancouver, not just situational, but it's just stuff like that is more out there. A healthy living, I started eating better and exercising and taking care of myself, definitely more than when I was in Winnipeg. Of course, the weather and the seasons is much more year round, so you're able to do that. I was able to play tennis outdoors for 10 out of 12 months of the year. So yeah, I think the move was critical. But it's not to say that someone who doesn't live in a place like Vancouver can't get into all this stuff. I just needed to get pushed over the edge by Neil and Alex to do some of these things, take myself out of my comfort zone. And before you know it, stuff is life changing. I can remember back in Winnipeg too, I had times when I was in so much pain, that I couldn't walk. I had foot problems for years. And looking back on it, I'm 100% sure that was all from my mind, believe it or not. You're sure you have an injury, but I carried those injuries with me for months, if not years. And same thing with back pain, I had it forever and ever. And I would try to stretch, and I would try to see a chiro. I would do all these things, and nothing was going to get it. But now I know that just from experience through that 10-day course, I know that it all comes from my mind. And I now know how to rid myself of it. So it's a very nice tool to have.
Yeah, and sort of an aside as you're speaking, you're in the tennis world, you're on the West Coast. Did you have any, or have you had any overlap with David Cox out there yet, or no?
I don't think so. What was the name? David Cox?
Yeah, so he's a clinical psychologist, sports psychologist, part of Simon Fraser. Just recently, I think in 2021, got inducted into the BC Sport Hall of Fame. He's on the mental side. Any, and if you're not connected, I'm happy to send you his number and get you guys connected out there. Just I was working with the Whitecaps in MLS, and he was the go-to sports psych with our club out there. And spent a lot of time in Tennis Canada and still does. He's very involved in the tennis world. So small circles, or maybe they get a little bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, sounds great. No, I don't know the name, but if you could connect with him, that'd be great. I do. I am close with Andre Manzik, who's a sports psychologist at Douglas College, and I've met with him a number of times. We go for coffee, and I had questions for him about the book, and he actually ended up being one of the editors for my book. And
Amazing.
he's just a great guy and super knowledgeable. And so yeah, it's good to have all these connections. So if you could pass that on, it'd be great.
Yeah, I'll reach out to him and see if we can connect the dots for sure.
Right on.
I highlighted something in your book when I was reading through it, and I'm gonna read it, and then let's just take it wherever we go from a conversational standpoint. One of the fascinating things in sport to me, and I think probably aging, maturing, whatever we want to call it, entering into different stages of life. Just becoming more aware of certain things, and this mental side of sport has really become heightened in the last little while. We have athletes now taking leaves to take care of their mental health. It's more of a talking point, but also an active component of performance. So just pulling from your book, to quote directly, we typically start with the sport, playing games and competing right away. Then as we get older, we start to develop athletic abilities. Not until later in life do we start to understand the importance of the mind and possibly begin to train it. And then you go on to say, in much of the Eastern world, the importance of the mind has been understood for centuries. In the West, it's now catching on, mainly because athletes and coaches are now realizing that mental training truly works. And this was, some of the reading that you were doing, and from a Shaolin temple and some of the places that you've been and experienced, like this is a major contribution. And so how do we, maybe I'll just spin this a different way. Is there inroads at younger ages to set the stage with this stuff so it becomes more mainstream? I mean, seeing LeBron James do this and seeing Simone Biles take a break to take care of mental health things, like in the public face. It obviously contributes to how we feel and how we react and how we respond. But I want to take that sort of from your expertise or your experience, working with high schoolers, working with lots of different age groups. Is there an age barrier to this, or can we start this, in amateur sport?
That was one of the goals of the book, was to get this into some younger athletes. I think you mentioned it early on. You said, it was an easy read. That was by design. I want a lot of people to be able to read this. I didn't want it to be so easy that it was like there wasn't much knowledge you'd get from it, but I wanted it to be simple for younger athletes. And just the other day, I'm here at my cottage in Victoria Beach, Manitoba, and there's some tennis courts just around the corner, and I often play there and I do some coaching and stuff. And of course, I'm selling some books right now, and I sold it to a young boy who's 12 years old, and he's a very high level golfer. He plays some tennis too, but he's a very high level golfer. And I gave it to him. I signed the copy for him, and like a week later, his mom came up to me and said, "Hey, I really want to thank you for the book. My son, he's loving it. He's read it front to back, and you wouldn't believe, but he's also meditating." I went, and I just kind of got shivers. I just thought, like, that's why I wrote the book. I want to positively affect the lives of others. I didn't write this to make money or to get famous or anything like that. There's no hope with writing a book on that. I wrote it to positively affect the lives of others, and particularly young athletes. And unfortunately for young athletes, they probably just don't understand the importance of it at that age, right? You're being coached on the technique and strategies and this and that, but you're not aware of the power of meditation and mindfulness and all these mental skills and tools that we have access to. So yeah, like I said, that's the goal of the book. And I discovered this in China because like that little excerpt that you read there from the book was about an experience I had at the Shaolin Temple, which is the birthplace of Kung Fu. And I spoke to one of the gentlemen there who is a Kung Fu master, and he said, "We go into the schools and we handpick the athletes, or I shouldn't say they're athletes, they're actually martial artists, but we handpick the artists that are ready for Shaolin. They might not be strong in school, but they're ready for Kung Fu. And the first thing we do when we bring them over to the temple is we get them meditating, and they have to get to a certain point of meditation before then we move on to, balance and flexibility, and then work up to agility and strength. And then you get into the flashy kicks and punches that you see in the movies of Kung Fu." But I just thought that was fascinating because, they get them meditating at a super young age, like 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old. They're meditating and they're grounding the mind. And watching these kids perform, they were just so grounded, so mentally tough. You could just see it. And it just like flipped the switch for me, thinking like, oh, they understand here the importance of this, and we don't really, I don't think. I mean, it's like you said earlier, it's catching on. Athletes like LeBron James, Steph Curry, many, many athletes, Phil Mickelson, Michael Jordan, the list goes on and on. They're all doing meditation. And it's catching on, but it at the younger ages it's not yet. But I think it's coming, because it is just such good stuff. And I think the earlier you can start it too, even just meditating for a couple minutes at a young age, you're really setting the table and you're setting the stage for the rest of your life, really.
Yeah, amazing. And there's been some other incidents, I guess. Where, I don't think I'm doing it justice, but in 2018 there was this soccer, I don't know if you recall the story, but the soccer team that was trapped in a cave in Thailand for I think about 18 days. And one thing that came out after they got rescued was they had very little rations of food. Obviously they had water, they were trapped in a cave with water, but what came to light was that their coach, who I think was 25 years old, took them through just like regulating their breath and trying to minimize energy exertion from that standpoint. And just, I mean, these things seem not part of our regular culture in the West. And when they become part of the regular culture, they spill into sport, and sport has become, a business at the amateur level in a lot of spaces, and we tend to lose focus on the overall development of the whole individual. And I think this is a really big part of it. And to swing back to your point on sort of simple messages and making positive impact, like that's exactly what I take away from this book. So congratulations on completing it, on all of the things that you've done. And as a practitioner of, 15 years now, like these are things that I continue to hope to empower athletes with tools and skills that they may not have been exposed to in the past. And it's books like this that we can put in people's hands, and they're going to be able to take things away without having a coach or without having you right beside them at the same time. So, message received, and again, like really well done on the book. It's again, I don't mean that as anything other than a compliment, an easy read and lots of takeaways.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Present day and sort of what you're doing now, reaching into the amateur space, connecting with athletes, your regular, like your life, this is part of your daily life. Do you have a rhythm or a routine? Like, I have to do this at a certain time, or I feel better when I do this at certain times, just like anecdotally on your end.
Yeah, I don't have a like a crazy rigid schedule, but definitely the one thing I do fit into every day is meditation. And the one thing I quite enjoy, and you would have come across it in the book, is I love to have coffee with meditation. And as I said in the book, you know, I'm sure the meditation gurus would frown upon you know, the idea of sipping coffee while you're meditating. But it's just something that works for me. Like, I love coffee, and you know, I can use the smell of the coffee and the taste of the coffee to keep me present in the moment. And I can even use it as a reset. You know, if I'm meditating and my coffee's sitting on my lap, and you know, my mind drifts off, it's, oh, take a sip. I like the taste, get the smell, and then I'm back to the breath, and then I continue to meditate. So coffee meditation most mornings is my routine. But I also have a pretty active dog that he'll sometimes whine at me to get out the door and take him for a run or whatever. So yeah, so I don't have a strict routine, but I definitely have to meditate every day. I try and hit the gym and lift weights as much as possible. I try to eat the right foods, stay active, spend time with my girlfriend, kind of all those things, those cliche or you know, buzzword things you would want to do or include in your life. But yeah, that's pretty much a typical day in life.
Yeah, I love that, man. And again, coming back to that magic minute, like, you know, you led with it. And I think in this day and age, it's like, give me something now that's going to give me an immediate, you know, payout. You know, that seems to be the lay of the land in our space, from a practitioner standpoint, from an athlete standpoint, from a coaching standpoint. Embedding that in, is it as simple as just like, hey, we're going to try this and like on a first timer, a group, well, hey, like, let's all do this together and see how we feel kind of thing. Do you use reflection as a tool with this as well?
Yeah. I mean, I would try all the tools out, you know, whether it's, meditating or journaling or, mantra statements, breath work. People are into the cold showers now. You know, the list goes on and on. There's all kinds of stuff you can do. Like my book, I think there's 130 stories. There's close to 130 different things that you can do. And, yeah, just try different things out. And, you know, some things you are going to get good bang for your buck. I mean, I know for me, meditation is the key for me, but it took me hundreds, if not thousands of hours to get to the point where I am now. So, you know, if someone's looking for a quick, you know, bang for their buck, I wouldn't necessarily say to meditate, but maybe a bunch of breath work or a cold shower or something like that might work. But again, I don't know the answer for that individual. It's sort of what works for them. So again, just try different stuff and find what you like and find what you think might work and just roll with it. And that's kind of your thing. And then you can put that into your routine.
Yeah, I love that. Regularity and routine, and then finding consistency, right? It may be a one-off and it may not feel the same every time, right? It's just like, you know, training any aspect from a physical standpoint. You know, some people need to feel, other people don't need to feel. They want to be able to walk out of the gym feeling better than when they came in and not feeling sore. But sometimes we can't predict that, depending on load or depending on, you know, all kinds of different stressors they have in their life. But simplifying it down to finding the thing that works, seems like a simple equation, sometimes a little bit more difficult than said, but I love that and consistency. So from that standpoint, finding this and doing it in a team setting, and then what's your take on sort of, you know, I don't want to say there's a formula that says you need to do this X amount of times and X number of days in a row, but consistency matters wherever you want to take that, and sort of, you know, I think one piece with the mental work and breath work is trying to make it happen makes it harder, you know, where you can sit back with it and just sort of like lean into it. I found in personal experiences with that is giving it the space that it needs and not forcing yourself to try and be better at it. Is that, I don't know if that's reasonable, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd add there would just be that, You know what? I think as long as you're doing something for your mind, like I said, there's a number of options that you can choose from. But I think if you're an athlete or a coach or someone that's trying to get to the next level and you're not doing anything to train your mind, I think you're missing a really big piece of that. You know, one interesting thing that kind of came about from the book, actually, it was early on in the writing of the book, is I was asking a lot of high-level athletes and coaches a couple of questions. I would ask them, hey, just give me a number. What percentage of your sport is mental? You know, and a lot of athletes and coaches would say, oh, it's really hard to quantify or whatever. I said, oh, just give me a number. And what I was finding was the numbers that were coming out were like 70, 80, even 90%. And then some coaches and athletes would say, oh, even in come playoff time, it's 100%. So I'd say, wow, okay, those are big numbers. And then I would say, so my second question, follow-up question would be, so what are you doing to train the mind? And like some of them would be like, you know, well, almost nothing. You know, they're not doing anything. So I said to myself, you know, that's a huge disconnect there. You're telling me that 90% or 80%, whatever the number is, of your sport is mental, but you're not doing anything to train your mind. You're doing full practices as, with technique and strategy. You know, that's sort of one thing that turned me around. I said, okay, I'm going to commit now to 20 to 30 minutes of every practice on the mind for my athletes. So this is for volleyball. So we'd have 2 hour practice typically. And we would meet in a classroom setting just outside the gym. And we would do stuff. We would do mental training. And that would be, like I said, maybe meditating or journaling or talking or planning or trying to discuss our last match and how we came to that mentally, whatever it may be. We would just spend that time dedicated. And I was just finding like it's just like a switch went off for the team. It was just like everything became better. We performed better at a higher level. Come crunch time, we were mentally tougher, with better team camaraderie. It also set the table for the practice. So even though our practice was shorter, you know, you take 20 to 30 minutes, that doesn't seem right. How can we waste that time? You're thinking, but then you get out there and they're so focused and they know exactly what needs to be done. And so you get a really good bang for your buck on that. So back to your question, yeah, I think as long as you're doing something, I don't think the means or the what the tools that you use really matters, but something that works for you to train the mind is super beneficial. Because if you're not doing that and your opponent is, you're going to be in tough.
Yeah, I love that. And maybe just simply just sort of shifting perspective to adding a little bit more intention to what you're doing or attention to the thing that you may not think is mental, like strategizing or, you know, play formation or, you know, technique can also have a mental component to it where education or intention become a little bit more of a heightened focus as opposed to just execution. So instead of end game, it's a little bit more process oriented, process driven.
Yeah, another thing we did was one quote I really like from Timothy Galloway is awareness is curative. So one thing I would do is I would have my athletes rank, give me a number out of 10 before and after every practice on their confidence level. And you know, just a general question, what's your confidence out of 10? And so before practice, they would give a number, they would write it in their journals or whatever it might be. And what was incredible is the numbers would just naturally go up without me really even coaching it or anything, just complete awareness. So they would start, some of them would start down low, like a 2 or a 3. But by the end of the year, we were getting in that sweet spot of about 8, 9. And I call that a sweet spot because you can also be overconfident, which you can even put numbers like 11, 12 out of 10, you know, because you don't want to come in overconfident. You want to be right in that sweet spot.
Right.
So we were trying to find that sweet spot. And in order to do that, we would just with sole awareness. So that's another little tool that you can do. And you can actually use those ranking out of 10 for not just confidence, but for kind of any mental aspect of the game. We even ranked it for each practice. You know, what was our attitude out of 10? What was our effort out of 10? Stuff like that. And all of a sudden, you know, halfway through the year, you're banging out awesome practices just because your athletes are aware and they want to raise that number. Oh, we had a 4 last practice. Okay, what do we want to do today? Let's get a 7. Okay, let's get a 7 out of 10. And then a little more focused, and they want to get that 7. Then you finish a practice. Oh, we got our 7 right on. Maybe tomorrow we can get an 8. Tomorrow we get an 8. All right, now we're getting somewhere. And that's all sort of that internal motivation versus external. So that's also powerful stuff that you can do, not just with the team if you're a coach, but as an individual athlete. Not even as an athlete, but it just as an individual living your life, you know, like what's your confidence right now out of 10? You know, rank it. And then see and do that every day for a while and see what happens. And I'll be willing to bet that number will go up.
Yeah, and in the workspace, working with colleagues, working with people, like this is a great entryway to figure and feel each other out as well. So even in outside of the sporting space, sticking with sort of quotes in the tennis world, Novak Djokovic had a great interview. I think it was actually from Wimbledon, and he was talking about, you know, what may separate himself from others isn't necessarily the ability to be present, but actually the recovery from emotion to bring yourself back. So when something goes wrong, how quickly can you come back to sort of that midline? So highs aren't too high, lows aren't too low. You're able to recover versus constantly thinking, I have to be present, I have to be present, I have to be present, because that even takes you away from being present. So it was an interesting interview. And he talked about sort of the one thing that he feels he does now better than anything else was conscious breathing. Like he does this as a tool to reset and to bring himself back when he feels overreactive or hyperreactive. And I thought that was, again, mainstream high-level athlete and in your world, in the tennis world.
Yeah, so with that one, what's interesting is a lot of athletes, when they, let's say they miss an easy shot, and they react right away, you know, they holler something out, they yell no or whatever it might be. And a lot of athletes will say, oh, I got to stop, you know, swearing at myself or cursing myself. But those are often hard to prevent. And so, you know, I know a lot of the sports psychologists out there are saying, you know, allow that to be, allow that emotion to play out. But what you touched on there, what Novak Djokovic does and what the best or the mentally toughest athletes out there do, is they're able to reset before the next point. Mm-hmm. Whereas a novice, someone that's not trained mentally, holds on to that and hangs on to it. And they go back to return the next serve or serve the next ball, and they're still hanging on to that. So Novak uses the breath. You can use any type of what's called a reset cue. You know, some athletes in the tennis court will hit their shoe or tap the ground or fix their strings or whatever it may be. And that's their cue to let that go. Doesn't matter if it was a poor shot or a really good shot. That's done. That's already in the past. I have to move on. And what's going on the next point, and start making a plan for the next point. And silencing the mind is a very important part that I talk about in the book. Right before a server return, we want to turn thinking off. So we let that emotion play out, and then we have a reset cue of some kind, might be the breath or whatever, and then we come back to present moment, and that enables us to perform just so much better.
Yeah, I love that. And maybe it's the unquantifiable, that Z word or Z word of the zone, you know, just like navigating that. And that's being able to stay locked in or get back locked in or whatever the thing might be, when the physical either body or the performance isn't going the way you want it to go. Can we regulate enough to get by without, you know, top level, or if you're fatigued or cramping or whatever those things may be, that helps us sort of maybe recenter or yeah, like you said, sort of silence those other critics that are constantly at battle, it seems, in our mind or in our body and mind. And there's obviously like an entanglement of body and mind, which, you know, again, like you mentioned, you know, there's a large part of sport and performance life that is mental, and how we cope with that internally matters.
Yeah, and I'll also add too, like sticking with the Novak Djokovic and the tennis theme, there is, you know, tennis has some downtime in between. You have a changeover and you have, you know, 90 seconds to sort of regroup there. And I'll tell you, that 90 seconds is so, so valuable. What you're doing in that time, you need to really pay attention to that. There was a final between Nadal and Medvedev, an Australian Open a few years back. And Medvedev was cruising up two sets to love. And all of a sudden, Medvedev started getting ticked off at the crowd because the crowd was cheering for some of his errors and double faults. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, he was, you know, during the changeovers, he was berating the umpire. And, you know, you could see him, the camera would be on, and then he'd be all up in arms. And then a few changeovers later, he was still berating the umpire, and the trainer was working on his legs. You know, he's trying to massage out all the pains and the cramps. I thought, from a mental standpoint, there's something wrong with this picture. You know, he has to find a way to to silence all that those thoughts in 90 seconds. And of course, he went on to lose because of that. His mind got the best of him. And then you look at Novak Djokovic, and pay attention, and even Rafa Nadal, you pay attention to what they're doing in the changeovers. It's very detailed. They have a routine. Sometimes Djokovic throws the towel over his head and closes his eyes, almost like a mini meditation there. So yeah, using those little chunks of time in between whatever sport you are. Hockey, those two intermissions. I mean, how important are those? What you're doing there is oh so important. So,
Yeah, I love it. And
have I read
again,
enough on that?
yeah, I love it. And I think like it really highlights again, the book is On the Ball, short stories, anecdotes, and words of wisdom on the mental side of sport. It highlights all of those things. We entered with a magic minute. These have been a ton of magical minutes. I hope the listeners out there are making notes, taking notes, and connecting, with you through whatever medium you prefer. I have your card in front of me. You have a website, you have Instagram. If people want to reach out to you, what's the best way to get you? You mentioned the book already. You can find it on Amazon, searching by your name. And again, the last name is LODEWYKS. But what do you prefer in terms of if people want to reach out to you or connect?
You can go to my website, which is michaellodowicz.com. And on there, you'll see the website's not too old. I've only had the book out for a couple months, but I'm starting to accumulate some stuff. I've got a few videos up there and a couple blogs posted. So there's more information there. I encourage you to pick up the book, though. I think it's valuable for all your listeners. And you can do that through the website, through Amazon, or you can connect with me. I can mail you a copy anywhere in Canada for $5. The book is $20 itself, so for $25, you'll have a book in your lap, and you can just order that through me through my email, which is linked to my website. So again, michaellodowicz.com, and you can also through there you can get to my Instagram and Facebook and those social media type things. And the only thing I'll say is I'd love to hear from you. Even I mean. If you don't buy a book, shoot me a message or friend me. If there's a story you have about a game or a competition where you performed really well and you have something to add or share, I mean, I love this stuff. This is what I live for. So I'm quite happy to chat about it and connect with people. So please reach out.
Yeah, awesome. And I'll post that stuff, the website and the Instagram accounts, those kind of things in the summary, with the publication as this rolls out onto Spotify and all the big sort of podcast hubs out there. Community matters and connection matters. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Harrison for connecting us. Harrison Brown gave me your name, said you two guys need to connect. And the first thing that came to mind was, let me read this book and get you on here. So really appreciate you carving some time in and from the cottage with the dog in the background. Is probably ready to get out and
Yeah,
run around a
exactly.
little bit. I'll leave you with that, whatever closing words you like, but really grateful for your time and all the work you've poured into this book. And I'll certainly be reaching out and get a few copies for our kids at the academy that I'm with in the fall and get this in their hands and see where we can take it from there.
I'll just close with shout out to Harry, Harrison Brown. He was a TA for me at UBC many years ago, but he's moved on to do some incredible things. And he's a great guy, so I still stay in touch with him. And I just want to say thank you, for doing all this, for reading the book. I really appreciate that. And you made all this happen and interviewing me. And you're also doing some incredible things over there. I haven't spent a lot of time in Toronto, and I've never met you, but I checked everything out on your Instagram and all that. So you're positively affecting the lives of others, and that's what it's all about. We can share our knowledge and our experiences, and try and make the world a better place, little by little, right?
Yeah, humbled, man. Really, truly grateful for your time. And if you haven't been here, maybe we figure out a way to get you here and get doing some work with some of the people that we work with, and vice versa. So, all the best. Really appreciate it. Good luck with the book. We'll keep plugging it on our side. Again, it'll be up on the summary when we publish this podcast. But all the best. Stay in touch, and I'll make sure that I connect you with Dr. Cox as well.
Thanks, James. Take care, everyone.
All right. Take care.
Thanks again for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of this community. Check us out online, firststartherapy.com. That's F-I-R-S-T-A-R therapy.com. Or email us with feedback, consult@firststartherapy.com. C-O-N-S-U-L-T @firststartherapy.com. On Instagram @firststar.therapy. And our podcast host @letschat.at. This is First Star Let's Chat, an athletic therapy podcast.